Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst, where we are smashing the barriers of exclusion and giving diversity a starring role. Tune in as leaders step up to tackle complex social justice issues by showcasing the best inclusion practices around. If you dig what you hear, please subscribe, share with friends, and give us your star-studded rating so that together we can keep on making inclusion happen.
What's up, everybody? This is Julian Geiser from Great Heart Consulting. My pronouns are he, him, and you're listening to the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. The goal of each episode is to give people the tools and resources they need to create inclusive environments that truly reflect the diversity of our modern workforce. I sit down with various agents of change to discuss the ideas, the opportunities, and the strategies that need to be implemented to effectively bring that change. Today on the show, we welcome Maurice Jones. Maurice A. Jones was appointed CEO of 110 in March of 2021. 110 is a coalition of leading chief executives and their companies who are coming together to upskill, hire, and promote 1 million Black Americans over the next 10 years who do not yet have four-year degrees into family-sustaining jobs with opportunities for advancement. Prior to joining 110, Maurice was the president and CEO of the Local Initiative Support Corporation, one of the country's largest organizations supporting projects to revitalize communities and catalyze economic opportunity for residents. He previously served as Secretary of Commerce and Trade for the Commonwealth of Virginia, where his primary job was to leverage Virginia's assets to solidify its position as the preeminent place to live, work, and conduct business. Maurice also served as Deputy Secretary for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development from April 2012 through January of 2014. As the second most senior official at HUD, Maurice managed the department's day-to-day operations, the annual operating budget of $40 billion, and the agency's 8,900 employees. Maurice received a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science from Hampton-Sydney College and attended Oxford University in England on a Rhodes Scholarship, where he received a Master of Philosophy in International Relations. He later received a Juris Doctorate from the University of Virginia. Maurice, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And before we get started today, I was hoping you might share a few of the aspects of your identity that are most important to you.
You know, I think there are probably a couple. First and foremost, I'm a country boy. So I was born and raised in a town of 1,200 people in rural Virginia on a farm by grandparents. Grandfather born in 1914, grandmother born in 1919. And we raised tobacco, we had corn, we had, you know, other crops and mules and cows. We were farmers. And so, you know, farming was my first job. It was living in rural Virginia was definitely for me, and being raised by grandparents who had gone through so much, those were the definitive influences in my early life, no question about it. And then I would say to you that I got a chance after college to spend three, after undergrad, to spend 3 years in Oxford in England. A country boy from a town of 1,200 living and studying in Oxford was a game changer for me. And so those two things in particular, I combine it with being married and having a daughter now who's a 20-year-old sophomore in college. Those have been, from the standpoint of the mortal world, amongst the most influential pieces of my journey so far.
Cool. Yeah, Oxford's quite a way from rural Virginia, that's for sure.
It's a little ways away, yeah.
A little bit.
I tell people, you know, my grandparents died never having traveled on an airplane. I studied for 3 years in another country, right?
Because of airplanes.
Because of airplanes and primarily because of them. Right,
sure.
Because of the love that they poured into me. So the world that I was able to experience was quite different from the world that they actually grew up in and ultimately died having mastered. And so But for them, you know, I wouldn't have seen these other worlds. So, yeah. You know, they I owe them everything I have.
Well, I appreciate the way in which you've kind of led into this second follow-up that I have for you, because I've heard you on a few podcasts. I've heard you mention your grandparents with deep passion and love for them. And I'd love for you to maybe share a bit more about who they were and how they continue to inspire you and the work that you're doing today, specifically at 110.
Yeah. So grandmother born in 1918 in rural Virginia, lived in town, and so was able to walk to school to get her high school diploma. Mm-hmm. Grandfather, who was born in 1914, actually lived like 10 miles outside of quote unquote town and went to school for 6 years in a barn. And could not go any further because of his color. The county was not going to send a school bus out 10 miles to pick up a little colored boy to bring him to the segregated schools. And so after 6 years in a barn, he went out and went to work. Mm-hmm. The two of them came together and were married, and they raised two of their own children. And then I went to live with them when I was 3 months old. And they raised me from the moment that I was in their home at 3 months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they taught me everything. We were farmers. My grandfather eventually owned his own sawmill. And so we worked at the sawmill, and they taught me hard work, and they wanted me to... they knew that getting an education was a big piece of what I needed to do to go as far as I could go in life. And so they always encouraged me there and showered me with love and care. And as I said, everything I have, I owe to them. No question about it. They sacrificed for me, for a world that they hoped that I would be able to live in, that they knew would probably come after their death. Mm-hmm. And they were working for something that was so much bigger than them, and that they knew they wouldn't see, that they would die before it all came to fruition. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to overstate just how critical they remain in my life.
Yeah. Well, it seems that they had such a, you know, listening to you speak about them, it seems evident that they had an incredibly strong commitment to legacy as a concept. And they put everything into you. And as you said, being aware that the fruits of their love and labor, not just on the farm, but into rearing you would come about when they had passed on, and that you would kind of carry that legacy forward.
They definitely taught me that the key to life was living for something much bigger than yourself. Mm-hmm. That's no question about it. So cool. I their spirit still resides within me.
Awesome. Well, and from a legacy standpoint, the organization that you lead, 110, is on a mission to connect Black talent with family sustaining jobs. So that's the goal is 1 million jobs in 10 years. And so at a foundational level, you all are really working to solve a significant opportunity and wealth gap that's been exacerbated by systemic racism and generations of inherited poverty. How do you all define family sustaining? And other than the obvious goal of 1 million jobs in 10 years, can you share some of the other main gaps that you're working to close?
Yeah. So my grandparents were the first 110ers that I actually knew. Both of them did not have a four-year degree. So we're focused on Black talent without four-year degrees and getting them into, to your point, family-sustaining jobs and careers over the next 10 years. For us, family-sustaining means that you are earning a wage that enables you to pay your bills, to save money for expenses like education and hopefully owning a home, to take care of your healthcare needs, your food, healthy food needs. We say it is about, at a minimum, a job that pays a living wage, not a minimum wage, but a living wage wherever that job is located. And we use, just so you and your listeners know, we use the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's living wage calculator to come up with what that number is. But that's how we define family sustaining. Minimum, the floor, a living wage.
Got it.
For the job that you're doing.
Yeah. Well, and I think
the second part of what you were asking.
Yeah, just so I guess what are there any other main gaps that you're working to close? And I think specifically, you know, that the some of the examples I know that you have on your website are that there's $143,000 difference in net wealth between Black and white families in the U.S. That 76% of Black adults in America do not have a 4-year degree, and that 79% of family sustaining jobs require a 4-year degree. So those are some of the other things that you all are really trying to address.
So you've nailed it. So this is about trying to bring about a skills first culture amongst our employers in this country. You just highlighted it, right? 76 of all Black talent in the workforce ages 25 and above don't yet have a 4-year degree. And yet 79% of all jobs that pay $60,000 or more require on paper a 4-year degree just to compete for the job. And so we literally have, in the form of a credential, a 4-year degree, a systemic barrier to Black talent and other talent earning their way into the middle class. And the reason why I say and other talent, 66% of all talent across all demographics in our workforce today, ages 25 and above, do not yet have a 4-year degree. So we know that if we solve this issue for Black talent without a 4-year degree, we actually are solving an issue that impacts most talent in the workforce today. This is an American opportunity or an American problem, depending on the way you want to look at it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what seems evident is that, you know, you talked about the best talent, right? And I think that we have this conception in the US that the best talent is always the most educated talent, and we have a pretty narrow definition of the pathway to higher education, and it typically resides in a 4-year degree, and it's a privilege to be able to afford it given how expensive it is. It means that you have to have all kinds of things line up for you in the years before you apply, that you have to come from a home that's stable and safe and a community that supports you, and it takes all kinds of it just takes a lot of privilege in order to be able to get to that point where, as an 18-year-old, you want to have the money and you have a sense of what it is you want to do. And I think, unfortunately, I think there's a lot of young adults who are going to college with no real sense of what it is that they want to do. And they go because that's what everybody does, or that's what the path is. And it's expensive, and it doesn't necessarily translate into, a great opportunity on the outside of it.
Well, here's the deal. Here's what we're trying to make sure of. Look, if a 4-year college experience makes sense for you on a number of different planes, meaning economically it works, family-wise it works, maturity-wise it works, then that's terrific, right?
Right.
What we're trying to say is that 4-year degree experience should not be the only way that you're able to earn your way into the middle class in America, right? Mm-hmm. Because a number of things, if you actually look at the data suggests to you and to me and to others, that actually the best predictor of success in a job is not your education, is not a degree. It's actually the skills that you bring to the job on day one and that you acquire thereafter. Turns out that skills can predict job success 5 times better than education.
Yep.
skills are actually even 2.5 times better a predictor of job success than experience. Huh. And so what we're saying is skills should be the dominant factor of success across the entire talent journey when it comes to hiring, when it comes to promoting, when it comes to development, that we need to focus on what skills do you need on day one? What skills do you need thereafter to keep advancing in a career or within an employer? Hmm. And you might acquire those skills through a 4-year degree experience. And you might acquire those skills through a boot camp, through training in the military, through an apprenticeship. We're saying we can't afford in this country to have one pathway to earning your way into the middle class. To the extent we do that, we suppress our economic prospects as a country, and we leave a lot of genius and talent on the sidelines.
That's a great point. Yeah, I like the focus on skills, and I'm curious, how do you all at 110, do you do boot camps? Like, what's the model that you utilize in order to upskill the workers you're placing, the talent that you're placing?
Yeah, so our model is to go out and aggregate the organizations that actually do that work.
Okay.
There are a ton of organizations all across the country, ranging from community colleges to military transition programs to apprenticeship programs to online boot camps. What we are trying to do is to assemble the best of those programs and to match those programs with talent and employers who have jobs to be filled, right? The whole idea is build an ecosystem. We need employers with demand for workers. We need workers. We need folks who can equip those workers to be successful. We need the other supports that workers need, transportation, childcare, those kinds of things. Our job at 110 is to knit those players together, if you will, into a high functioning team to get this work done. That's what we try to do.
Got it. Cool. Well, I followed you on LinkedIn, and I did see recently that you shared that the Pennsylvania's governor, Josh Shapiro, his first executive order was to remove the 4-year college degree requirement for 92% of Pennsylvania state jobs, which opened up 65,000 positions. So I feel like that's like a pretty, you know, often that 4-year college requirement is an obvious barrier, as you indicated. What's the progress in terms of getting organizations or even government organizations to remove those kind of barriers?
Here's the deal. We've got 72 companies in our coalition who've committed to the 110 mission.
Okay.
Those companies from March of 2021 to the end of September of 2022 hired and promoted over 73,000 Black talent without 4-year degrees into living wage jobs and beyond.
73,000.
So it's over 73,000. So you've got a critical mass of companies who joined 110, plus you've got actions taking place like what the governor of Pennsylvania just did. The Governor Hogan did it in Maryland. The governor of Utah also did something similar. So you're seeing public and private sectors understand that skills need to be the focus, and that we can't put barriers in the way of genius like credentials, 4-year degree requirements, while we've got over 11 million unfilled jobs out there, that we need to make sure that we are giving folks a chance to be the best they can be, so we can benefit from that as a country, as a community, as individual states, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I see this skills first trend continuing to scale, continuing to grow in both the public and the private sectors.
Yeah. You're aggregating the qualifications of these multiple organizations. And one of the roles I imagine you also have to play is helping organizations talk about skills qualifications internally, because if you have a a base of employees who got into the roles, into the organizations by having four-year degrees. I'd imagine there's some, you know, there's a little bit of hesitation sometimes to take such a radically different approach to qualification for roles that they might have otherwise competed for.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. Look, a big piece of this work is about the mindsets that we all hold, that we hold as people, that we hold as employees, that we hold in the public sector. And that mindset is biased in favor of a four-year degree right now for quality opportunities. Now, look, here's the deal. This is not an effort that is juxtaposing a four-year degree with skills. Right. That's not the point. The point of this is, should the fact that you don't have a four-year degree by the time you're 21 prevent you from gaining gainful employment that allows you to make a living? Our answer is emphatically no. That, look, 21 might be the age by which you get a four-year degree. 31 might be that age. 41 might be that age. 51. This is a lifelong journey. You might stack credentials and apprenticeships, and there should be multiple ways to go about this. And so the mindset piece that we have to move across the country is that there's no one gold standard that you have to adhere to in order to attain the dream that is America. That we have to, for our own sake, have multiple pathways, all of which are legit, all of which can lead to excellence, and that are open to people wherever they start from, right? Some people can afford to go to college at 18, 19, 20, 21. Some people's life circumstances don't allow them to afford that. And because they don't, should not eliminate you from going wherever you can go from wherever you are. And so that's the point that we're trying to make. That is mostly a mindset shift. That's a mindset shift across the country that we are trying to contribute to transforming.
And you talked a little bit about veteran retraining programs, about vocational programs, apprenticeship programs, as some of the critical community partners that you have. Are there other members of the community that you are relying on to help with this mind shift?
Absolutely. So look, we need childcare providers on the team, because a big piece of whether you're able to hold down a job or pursue a skill or upskilling is, do you have the childcare support services that you need for your family in order to do this stuff? And so transportation, right? Same thing, right? If you're living in the city of Philadelphia and the jobs are in the suburbs of Philadelphia, you need an affordable, efficient way to get there if you're going to be a reliable employee.
Sure.
And so there, we've got to bring about this sense of what's needed and the mindset changes that we need across the private sector, but also in the nonprofit sector, in the support sector, in the public sector. Yeah, we need a bunch. This is a team sport. We need a bunch of different elements whose vision of excellence is much broader than a four-year degree holder. That is what this is about. Absolutely.
I love it. That's awesome. I think you're obviously building lots of bridges, you know, resourcing organizations that probably just need partners like you to help develop pipelines into these family sustaining roles. So it's a critical function that you're serving.
Well, you're kind. The great thing about this is, for a number of reasons, the insight here of skills first, of the need to scale skills first cultures, is being driven by a number of different factors, right? Mm-hmm. One is that there are 11 million jobs that are going unfilled. And so employers are realizing very quickly that they have to try different things in mm-hmm. order to get the talent that they want, right? That is a big piece of this. The other pieces are the pieces that you mentioned up front. When you look at the data and you realize that we are just locking genius out because we're putting self-inflicted wounds. We're in front of getting our access to talent. I mean, these things are conspiring together now to create a really fertile environment for us to make a mindset shift that I hope will be transformative for generations to come.
I think that's an excellent point. And I think one thing is that's evident is this isn't charity, right? It's good for everybody and it's good for business, you know?
Yeah.
So there's really good reasons to do this.
We cannot be great and leave millions of people on the sideline.
Absolutely.
It's just not a sustainable plan for being great.
Yeah. Well, as I was preparing for this interview and this conversation, I was thinking about Black excellence because you all are very much promoting Black excellence and folks who are already excellent. And I found a fantastic article that I'll make sure to share when we post this episode by Dr. Janice Kassam on some of the complications around the idea of Black excellence in general. And since 110's work is already leveraging this community of folks who are excellent, how do you view any tensions inherent in this idea of Black excellence as you're promoting Black talent into these roles?
I don't feel any tension on this. I mean, I think the point of our journey is to broaden one's perception, one's conception, one's assumption of what excellence looks like, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, excellence looks like a white individual with a four-year degree, probably from a few select schools, mm-hmm. right? That is the, it's a generalization, so it is inherently inaccurate, right? Inevitably right. inaccurate, but that's what excellence mostly looks like. What we're trying to do is to broaden that hypothesis, that conception, that notion of what excellence looks like, to particularly in our case, include Blacks who do not yet have four-year degrees, mm-hmm. right? And so this is a conception or an image that we're trying to contribute to including into that sense of excellence everywhere, right? We want employers, employees, the public sector, we want America in general to mm-hmm. understand that the picture of excellence that we have mostly adhered to is a narrow one that is in no one's interest to hold on to, no one's, particularly our countries.
Yeah.
And it's contrary to fact. I mean, that's the bottom
right.
line, right? What we know is that excellence and genius exist everywhere in all kinds of hues and shapes. What is missing is broadly shared opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to advance.
Yeah, that access piece is critical.
Oh, it's critical.
Yeah. Well, for leaders that are, you know, maybe already in these organizations, so our hoped for target audience with this podcast is leaders who are in positions leading, whether they're individual contributors, but are influencing culture in the organizations in which they work. So one of the questions I have is, you know, what are three things that they can be doing to support the talent that is being placed by an organization like 110? Are there particular things that they could be doing to help that talent?
no question that there are things that need to be done to make sure that talent can be the best it can be, can thrive, can stay, et cetera. So one thing is focus on skills, right? Become a skills first culture. Help to transform that workplace into one where skills become the dominant factor across that Black talent's entire journey, right? Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, look, what we've seen is you need mentorship programs and sponsorship mm-hmm. programs for that talent. You need folks, we all need folks who are, in the words of the musical, in the room where it happens when right. we're not there, mm-hmm. right? Advocating for us, extending personal capital on behalf of that talent. Mm-hmm. So that's the second piece. The third piece, I would say, is that you absolutely need to create an environment, a culture where people feel a sense of belonging, where mm-hmm. people feel like you want me here for all of me, not just the product I can produce on behalf of the company, but you want all of me. Mm-hmm. And so that's an environmental piece. That's creating a sense of belonging and welcoming that is very cultural, that requires a number of different things to be in place on a long-term basis, including such things as resource groups, for example. Mm-hmm. Those are things that we all can do and be a part of in the organizations that we work in order to make sure that that talent has the best chance to show you how great she is and can be.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, those are great. So three things are the shift to culture to a more skills first culture, the focus on mentorship and sponsorship, making sure that we have programs in place that can support these leaders. And then the third one, obviously, is that belonging piece, which I think is you're right, is critically important.
Yeah. And those are
three great ones. And so last month was National Mentoring Month. And I saw you comment on the importance of effective mentorship. And one of the things that I think is worth saying is that I think the most effective mentoring and sponsorship relationships are ones that are reciprocal, where, you know, often it's very top down. You've got someone who's taken time out of their busy schedule to inculcate someone with this knowledge that they have and bestow it upon them as some kind of, you know, gift. And I think one of the unfortunate things is what's often missed in that kind of formulation is that there's net benefit to everybody again, right? So you're going to learn as much as a sponsor of someone or as a mentor as you are as if you're a mentee. And I think there's an energy there. There's a momentum that you can build that can, one, it benefits, you know, benefits both of you, but it also creates a culture of belonging. If people are entering in a relationship with an understanding that every relationship we're in is reciprocal and beneficial to both people.
It is a great point. Indeed, we've got some mentoring programs that actually mentor up, mm-hmm. where the mentor actually is the employee who has less tenure mm-hmm. in the organization, actually teaching the person with more tenure what that experience looks like through their eyes. But to your point, the best mentorship programs are the ones with reciprocity, mm-hmm. where the mentoring and the menteeing, if that's a right word, go both ways. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's key.
Well, I like about that point where, you know, where you do the reverse mentoring idea is I think it does, it reinforces, it helps sustain this idea of shifting the culture and the mindset towards skills, more of a skills culture, because it's often those folks that are, you know, maybe individual contributors or more mid-level who are, in terms of at least like the transactional pieces that keep the company successful or are selling the products or are marketing the products, who have some of those classically more tangible hard skills. And sometimes, you know, by the time you're a senior leader, I mean, we've all had to manage up. So we all know what that feels like. And I think we've all been aware of like, man, if only my manager knew how to do this thing or that thing.
You got that right.
And having a formal opportunity to provide that And it's humbling. It can be really humbling, I see lots of
it is humbling. It's humbling, and the bottom line for us, right, is we need to make sure that we've got workplaces that are high functioning and intergenerational.
For sure.
Right. And so the mentorship going both ways is a key sort of tool for pursuing that kind of place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love thinking about all the various ways in which it could build a greater sense of belonging. You know, we talk about building investment in a company or an organization. And I think we all are far more invested if we feel like, regardless of our seniority or tenure, we have influence. You know,
And it's a great retention tool, by the way. A great retention tool.
I'm sure. Sure it is. Yeah. Well, cool. Well, so this is Inclusion Catalyst. So I've got to ask, other than the obvious benefit of the work that you all are doing at 110, what's one example of something you've seen an organization do recently that's really catalyzing change and bringing greater inclusion to the workplace?
Wow. I mean, there are so many things. So let me stay on this theme.
Sure.
So one of our companies, and they don't call it sponsorship. They call it protege, and I forget what the sponsor is, but it is a sponsorship program,
right.
Basically. I just wish I could. This is a senior moment I'm having. But what you see is they have matched people with folks who are basically traversing their journey. And what's happening is they are, through these relationships, they are creating an opportunity for a person to really get mentorship and a real advocate. That's what it is, advocate and protege. That's exactly what it is. And that advocate is opening up not just opportunities for that person to keep getting promoted, but what we saw, and this was Dow who was presenting to us, what we saw was a real relationship that established trust and that really convinced the protege to actually take a risk to go outside of her comfort zone to take a job that in the end was great for her widening her portfolio of skill sets, but was one that initially she was resisting because it wasn't within her comfort zone.
Right.
Right. And so it's transformed her journey, but it's also transforming the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just a small example of the kinds of things that we are definitely seeing companies do. We're certainly seeing companies, for example, remove 4-year degree requirements in a huge way. Right. We just published a case study on the Cleveland Clinic. And in that case study, you can see that they decided that skills first as a way of hiring and promoting was actually relevant to several of their job categories. And this is a world-class health enterprise, right? Mm-hmm. With operations in, yes, Cleveland, but London and Abu Dhabi, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
They decided that, you know what, this skills first approach is definitely the way to do it. And so they committed to removing the 4-year degree requirement from thousands of their jobs. That just changes the game for them, particularly in a place like Cleveland that has a huge Black population who do not yet have 4-year degree requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go on from there, but the bottom line is, we're seeing companies all over the country really do some innovative stuff and work to transform their companies into skills first cultures. And it's definitely a work in progress.
Yeah.
There's no perfection in the human form that I've seen yet, but lots of good work.
I have a a connected question that I'm just remembering as I prepared for this. I was thinking about it because I wear a little bit of an HR hat in my current organization as well, and I've been the one who's developed our hiring process. You know, you talked about skills, the return on investment when you focus on skills as opposed to academic credentialing or even experience. For folks who are in a hiring process, how are you quantifying someone's skills? How's it affecting the hiring and qualification process for a candidate?
It's a great question. And different companies have different ways that they're now trying to assess skills, right? Mm-hmm. One is if they go to an 8-week coding boot camp, right, and they successfully navigate that, then the chances of them having real coding skills that you can use are pretty high, mm-hmm, right? So one is that, you know, that kind of training, that skills work that they're doing. But, you know, you see companies building in questions and interviews, mm-hmm, to assess skills. You see companies basically getting folks to do programming during the interview or beforehand. Mm-hmm. There are other kinds of tests that companies are using to assess skills. By the way, companies have been assessing skills for years.
For sure. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, this isn't the first time that they've been asked to do that. We're just asking them to do it on a much broader basis than they have heretofore. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are a number of different apprenticeships are another way where you can literally work with the prospective employee for a while they're actually also training. It's mm-hmm. the earn and learn model. That's another way that you see employers doing it. Mm-hmm. So no one should think that there is no way to do this. There are actually multiple ways that folks are going about doing it.
Awesome. Well, and finally, Maurice, before we let you go, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online?
Absolutely. Well, you can certainly find 110 at 110.org. Mm-hmm. And you can certainly find me at maurice.jones at 110.org, right? And I also am on LinkedIn and Twitter and all those good things. So, but 110.org is the place that I will send you to.
Well, Maurice, thank you so much for today's conversation. You are all leading some wonderful work at 110, and I hope you're able to double that 1 million jobs goal. Sounds like you're getting some incredible results, so you may need to.
We need look to
bump
forward
that
to
up
it
a little bit. You know,
we look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, so that brings us to the end of this episode. Special thanks again to Maurice Jones for joining us for an honest and great-hearted discussion. And thank you to our listeners for spending this time with us. We hope that you heard something of value and that it helps you to lead more inclusively. Do you know anyone that needs to hear this message? If so, be sure to click that share button. You can connect with me, Julian Geiser, and Great Heart Consulting on LinkedIn. As always, thanks for listening to Inclusion Catalyst. Maurice, you have a great day.
You too, my friend.
Take care. Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.